Hi, this is Ralph Towner. You're listening to Power Spot on 2SER FM with Hans Stove.
Thank you very much, Ralph Towner, for your time tonight. I'm wondering, I'm going to start my first question with a question about Italy. I'm wondering if for you, if living in Italy, is it good for your soul?
Absolutely. I'm madly in love with my wife, my Italian wife. That's really the reason I moved here anyway. So, and we've been here 13 years. I've been here 13 years now. I had a house in the States for the 3 years ago, and I sold it, and we moved to Rome from Palermo. Actually, we lived in Palermo for 10 years, and I still kept this house in the States for quite a long time, and then sold it, and now I'm completely, this is where I live now, completely.
Yeah, well, I guess I was sort of going to lead on to my next questions, but how do you feel about America these days?
Well, I mean, if you want me to be very candid about it, it's a bit of an embarrassment and a great disappointment. This administration has done things that are really stupefying. I mean, they've shut down the press. They completely mislead everyone. I'm surprised that the nation, you know, fell for this in the first place. I mean, now you're seeing some. The news here is a lot more revealing. The news there, I'm surprised at how reluctant it is to criticize. I mean, it criticizes the government and Bush, but you really see what's going on in Iraq over here. I mean the ugly truth of it, and it's, you know, this was apparent long ago, and the only surprise is really to what lengths or depths this administration's gone to cover itself up and lie and mismanage things. So as far as being an American, I mean, you can't say you're not, you know, I'm still an American. I'm still paying my taxes there. But, I'm not exactly thrilled to announce, I'm not very proud of that country, the way it's going. And there are a lot of theories, I have, but I won't waste anybody's time with that. But just to say, I think I've said it, really.
Yeah, so by the sounds of things, you're not in a hurry to move back to the United States.
No, I don't miss it. Well, I've been touring in Europe for so long. I mean, I lived in New York City for 14 years, which really isn't that much of a part of America, actually. New York City is kind of a separate country, and that was home for me really for a long time, but ever since the early 70s I've been touring in Europe and basically all over the world, but mostly in the European countries, and so I've always, and plus I learned to play the guitar in Vienna. That's where I studied. When I took up the instrument, I went right to a master real great teacher in Vienna, Austria,
and Karl Schenk, wasn't it?
Yeah, in the music academy. So I've kind of been Europeanized since my early 20s. So it's not such a drastic thing for me, you know, to be in a country that speaks a different language.
Sure. Now, look, you know, obviously, you were playing music at a very early age, I may say here, and you obviously come from a musical family. I'm wondering, would you tell us a little bit about them and I guess how they influenced you and your own sort of musical upbringing?
Well, music was a very natural part of the house, and every one of my sisters and brothers all played instruments very well, and all their children that they've had since. In fact, my oldest sister, late sister, actually. She has a son older than me, so I've been an uncle before I was born, actually. So all her children were the same age as me, and they all played instruments very well. And we had quite a number of instruments in the family that we could actually have a complete orchestra. We represented the woodwinds and the brass and the string violins, and my mother was a piano teacher and church organist, actually, and And it really, my starting to improvise when I was really young and able to pick up things from records and the radio kind of astounded them. I was the my ability to improvise or imitate music and sort of dream music up kind of surprised them. We lived in such a small town in the middle of the state of Oregon, right on the edge of the desert and with the mountains, kind of alpine mountains on one side and desert on the other. And there were it was only one radio station, so I didn't hear... Most of my influences were from my older brother's records from World War II, those collections of records.
Sure.
And a lot of swing music, early Nat King Cole and Duke Ellington, and,
sure.
and a lot of... and then Gershwin, and a lot of... so I heard a lot of music in the little town, oddly enough, every elementary school, three elementary schools, they all had... a band program, a symphony orchestra program, and a chorus. This is amazing. These are elementary schools in a town of 9,000 people, and each elementary school had these incredible music programs. And it was astounding. I had a wonderful elementary music teacher that just was thrilled about my improvisation. So in the school bands, I was admitted to the school band at a very early age, so I forget how old I was. I think when I was about 7 or 8, I was put in the advanced bands and things like that. I probably started with the trumpet. Anyway, but everyone encouraged me. The thing I know about my childhood is it was complete encouragement. If I'd probably grown up on the East Coast, I would have been put into a music school or like a music academy or immediately when I was young. And so I'm very fortunate that didn't happen in a way, because I had one of these idyllic childhoods playing baseball and then and improvising music. And so it was a really just wonderful upbringing, really.
Yeah, no, it sounds
with
fun.
Nothing but encouragement. And I think that's really the key, is to have I never had any resistance or any suggestion that maybe I was being impractical being a musician.
No, that's a good story. Now, you're a latecomer to the guitar. 22, I believe, you sort of picked it up.
That's right. Now, it was the last year in the university I was studying composition, was what I wound up doing, a classical composition, 12-tone rows and things like that, which was popular then, serial music back then. But the last year, I thought I heard someone playing the classical guitar, another student who wasn't a music student. But at that time, I was also buried in trying to play the piano like Bill Evans. And I heard this guitar, and I thought, my God, this sounds like a keyboard instrument, really. And so my whole... I managed somehow to buy a... cheap classical guitar, and then I wrote a piece for flute, I think, and guitar, with a really difficult flute part and a guitar part that I could kind of scratch out to myself. I had sort of tried to teach myself for about a month. I had it about a month, and I wrote this piece, and just the thrill of performing and realizing what a great potential. And at that point, I needed this. I really kind of conferred on myself this drastic need for discipline, because I don't think I was too disciplined as a musician, really. Maybe too much praise in some ways.
Yeah, so,
you know, sometimes you're talented and you're everyone's golden boy. I mean, after a while, I mean, you need to compare yourself, and you need to really buckle down. And at that point, I decided to study the instrument and not try to self-teach myself, which is... can be a real mistake sometimes. You'll go down the wrong road and takes forever to undo some really inefficient and, I mean, kind of bad habits on an instrument for technique. So I managed somehow to find out about this Carl Scheid, and I went to Vienna. I had never been east of eastern Oregon, so it was... I threw myself out. By then, both my parents weren't living at that point, so I was really just free. I had no one really, not that I think they would have offered any resistance, but so I went off with hardly any money and made it all the way to Vienna and studied, and I ended up studying 2 years with this great teacher. But after 1 year, I was able to play classical concerts because, after all, I was a musician, and that's all I did for that first year. Maybe 10 hours a day for a year.
That's right. I was going to ask you about the regime. I know when I had a look at your website, there was some reference there from one of the previous interviews in terms of you having played 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. I mean, it sounds like...
I had a lot of time to make up.
Exactly. It sounds like...
But it's possible to do when you have no money, no place to go, and no in an unfamiliar country. The rest of the students were poor, and they were... very hard to reach, I mean, to go visit. I mean, nobody had any money to do anything. So my intention for being there was, it's incredible. I mean, it's really true. I did spend that much time. And I compressed, I think, in a year. In fact, it worked better. I sometimes think it's not such a bad thing that I started so late because having a musical concept but no... notions about how to play the guitar, no prejudices about the instrument or no ego whatsoever on being a guitarist and having a great teacher. And plus, I think had I started the instrument when I was younger, I would have been distracted. I was saying, oh, I don't want to practice. I'll go to a movie or go out and play baseball. You know what I mean? I mean, in a certain way, I think I accomplished more. Sounds like such a late start, but I think really the early starts or late starts really depend on your situation, not your age so much. And I had no responsibilities to anyone except myself, so it was perfect.
Hmm? Yeah. Now, Carl Scheidt, if I'm not wrong, he died in the about early 80s, wasn't it, 84 or something?
Yeah, he did. I mean, there's a great guitarist, Jochen Schubert, that lives in Australia, a great classical player that lives and teaches there, and he's German. But he was one of my co-students when we were with Scheidt. I mean, he was further along than I was. But
let's talk about Oregon a little bit, if you don't mind. Can I get you to maybe talk about the early days of Oregon? What was it like for you? And I mean, what were your aims with the group and your hopes with the group at the time?
Well, the group, we were in that golden era in New York City, really, and it's a New York City group, and the name came, although Glenn and I, the bass player and I, are from Oregon, and the name was given to the band by the oboe player who was originally from Pennsylvania, so, but the band is, we all lived in New York City, and that's how we met. And the early days of, in New York, that was the time when all the new bands were forming, Weather Report and Mahavishnu and even Chicks Return to Forever. And just a lot of great groups were trying to alter the music and writing, kind of extending the jazz vocabulary a bit away from bebop, and the nice thing at that time was everyone was playing together, so I mean, we would have sessions and all the sort of maybe bebop jazz barriers were kind of dropped. You had to be able to play jazz but to be admitted into this club, it was just a great scene. I mean, with the Brecker brothers and everyone, and we were playing in lofts and having these wonderful rehearsal kind of jam sessions where you would actually rehearse new music and talk about it rather than just play standards and not open your mouth, you know. But the group Oregon, it just fit together, these unusual combination of instruments. And really, I started writing music that I felt sounded very comfortable for that ensemble. And I had worked 1 year with Paul Winter's group, this unusual combination of cello and oboe, and always had acoustic guitar and hand percussion and acoustic bass. And he kind of hired Colin Walcott, Glenn Moore, and myself in one one hiring, and we joined this group and discovered his oboe player. In about a year later, we took 4/6 of the group and made our own group.
Did that create bad vibes between you, or?
No, not really. No, it was done. It was done amicably. Really, there was no. We kind of formed our group and played, and Paul would now and then go back and play a concert with Paul. So, I mean, there was nothing. There was no violent thing or like big argument. I mean, we found this incredible relationship between the four of us, and we had our own ambitions about how to play. And it was really, we were really a city group, and things just worked so well between the four of us that we wanted to pursue it as a group. So it was kind of a natural departure from, but the Paul Wiener concert kind of rescued particularly Glenn and I from playing in bars and just jazz, basically pure jazz life, and so we got to leave New York and go on tour in college concerts and experience playing before real concert audiences.
Mm. I was going to ask, did you at the time, I suppose, have a feeling you were going to be as well accepted as you were by the public with the sound that you created with Oregon?
No, I mean, I don't. It's hard to think in those terms. In fact, it's still hard for me to understand if we're accepted or not.
I mean, that. I was going to ask that too.
I've always been so internal. I mean, all my work is done in a private room, you know, in a room or wherever I happen to be composing or practicing, and the aspect of how popular or how well known you are is so far down on the scale of what I put my energy into or attention to that I'm really surprised at the number and kinds of people that when I do find out that they happen to be interested in what I do, and I don't know if we had any idea, but we were so obviously wrapped up in the music that we're playing that we're still together 35 years later. So that tells you really how powerful this musical ideal is. And because you can't stay together if your motivation is for fame or money. You don't see too many groups stick together very long if that's their motivation. You see some let's see, there's a few rock groups that are still together, like the Rolling Stones or something, but they really believe in their music. If they didn't enjoy their music, they wouldn't be playing it because they have plenty of money. So
that's right. We're not in it for money anymore. let's change focus a little bit, if we may. Let's talk about a relationship you've had for a long time, and that's, of course, with the ECM label and Mumford Isher. How did you get involved with Mumford Isher in the first place?
Again, it's a New York City thing, a result of that great time in the late, like 68, 70, in the early 70s. I was playing a concert with Dave Hall, and was Dave's concert, I believe, and Mike Brecker was the horn player, and I was playing electric piano and classical guitar, and I think Bobby Moses was the drummer, but Dave knew Manfred. Dave introduced Manfred to me, and Manfred, at that point, ECM, there was only three or four records out, and Manfred was interested, but at the time, he was also interested in Oregon, but at the time, Oregon had just agreed to sign a 9-record deal with Vanguard Records, but he was interested in me as a soloist. It wasn't long after that I'd done the Weather Report record, but he was this very quiet person. Anyway, it seemed like an interesting thing. I didn't know at the time that it was. So 2 years later, then I did the first record called Trios and Solos, and kind of used everybody from Oregon on it, which actually gave us some problems with Vanguard Records. Anyway, that got me started with Manfred, and then just the ideals of it. I mean, the Manfred's brilliant idea was to take a particular kind of improvising musician, jazz musician, from the States and also in Europe, but like Keith Jarrett or Chick, and record them solo or in small combinations that the American record companies wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. You know, because if you're a jazz player, then you had to have a drums, bass, and a horn, you know, or a piano trio at least. But you didn't hear so many piano solo records or strange combinations of instruments. But what he really did was record with the improvised music with the classical standards of recording quality. This was rather innovative. Plus, we would do all the records were done in one day, 2 days, and they still are. That's why they sound as spontaneous as they do, because it takes a certain kind of player to be able to play in that short amount of time and be able to accept their playing, because you don't have a lot of time to do a lot of fixes and overdubs and corrections. But anyway, the money goes into the quality rather than... All those records go into the black almost immediately, because it's not like waving around a huge advance necessarily, but sometimes it's pretty big. But in general, it's idealistic music... quality of music and idealistic way of thing, and all the records, including all the musicians, we do the recordings one contract at a time, so no one's under any long contract, including Keith, I think. So in a way, you are free to record on other labels, but there's a certain kind of tacit kind of contract you have. But I just finished 2 days ago. My new solo recorded with Manfred in it. This time we recorded in the church, and we did it more in a classical way, just using the sound of the church and the guitar and not a kind of studio, but rather do maybe two takes and then combine, you know, they'd do whatever editing we could do at the time. But that was done the recording was done in one day, and then the editing we did the second day, and that was it. It's all fixed, and it just sounds fantastic. It's really the best, one of the best recordings I've ever done, I have to say. So that's all done, but it won't be released until maybe the spring.
Oh, okay.
But Manfred was great on that. I mean, it's wonderful, and we realize that we've been together 30 years now.
That's a long time.
It's a little, strange for me to look at Manfred, because I'm not looking at myself and see how gray we're getting, and I don't feel old, you know, but that's quite a few years with the same record company. But the advantage is I have a whole kind of life's work on one record label, all available, still available, you know. And that's another fantastic thing about ECM. It's a catalog company.
And the other thing, of course, is they all sound fresh still. You know, that's the thing about ECM. You can listen to a recording that was done 30 years ago, and it's still exciting to listen to.
Oh, that's nice to hear. I mean, I always felt that way about it. I mean, in the beginning, everything that came out was like a classic in its way. I mean, some really great records, but there's still some great ones being made. It's amazing that this one man has been present in almost all those recordings. How he can stand to listen so much music is amazing. But that catalog has really gotten big right now. It's huge. So here I am. I mean, just having finished what I feel is the best playing I've done on a recording on the guitar, just a guitar solo record, and I'll play some of these new pieces in Australia that I...
Let me ask you something. How come you never recorded more solo albums for ECM? I think to date there's been, what, four or so? Or...
Yeah, this is the fourth, and that's a good question. I mean, I probably should have done it more often. The thing is, I've always had organ, and I have to write most of the music for organ, and then there are other projects, and the thing about a solo record, you really have to, I mean, I have to compose all the music, and in writing solo pieces is a lot more difficult than writing for a group, because you have to be able to play the whole works as a soloist, you know, on the guitar. I mean, every part, if it's really sounds as though there are parts. I mean, it's just a lot more work, labor intensive, I guess you would say, to compose enough material for an entire CD. And it's getting even more difficult because CDs are longer.
They want 80 minutes.
Records used to be 48 minutes long,
that's
or something.
Right, 40 maximum. Look, I'm just wondering, looking back at that big back catalogue of yours, whether it's with Vanguard or Intuition or ECM or whatever, which ones are your favourite albums, and I guess why?
Well, I sort of like the most recent. The most recent Oregon record I'm very pleased with, very proud of. The Intuition record has just come out. On Cam Jazz. That's a label here in Rome that's really, really very good. And that's a wonderful record. It's a new one, and we recorded it in Oslo, oddly enough, in with Jan Erik Kongsag. So it's kind of got a strange thing. So I love that. I would think, though, over the years, my favorites. I mean, I always loved the First Solstice record. I mean, it won a lot of prizes too with Jan. Mm. And I used Jan Garbrek, young Garbrek, and young Eberhard Weber and Christensen, and that was that record still sounds has the same impact. You really wouldn't know it hadn't was made that long ago. It could have been made last week. Sound just as up to date, really. So I love that. And Oregon records, some of my favorite. I think Crossing was one of my favorite. The last one with Colin before we had our terrible crash and he was killed. And that's really one of my most favorite Oregon records. But I always keep rediscovering these things. Every now and then I'll say, oh, now how did that one piece go? And I sort of go back to check on an older piece that was on an older Oregon record, and I play the record and say, this is fantastic, the group or the recording. And there's there's sort of a great record representative of every version, some great records that Treloc did with this, the Treloc period in Gertu. Let's see. And I guess the solo concert record that I did, the live solo concert record, so many years ago in Zurich, and some concerts in Zurich and some in Munich that were used on that recording. That's a good live record, solo guitar record. Oh, and I always like Blue Sun, because that's one where I played every instrument that I knew how to play on it. A one-man band overdub record.
Okay, let me ask you something. Does your attitude to music change as you get older? Has that changed?
Well, I suppose it does. I mean, and my direction seems to be, I mean, with this solo record, I hear a lot more mastery of dynamics and articulation and expressions and things that are more leaning toward the classical way of playing, and even more now, I would say. I keep sort of having a certain kind of interest in a certain facet of the instrument that I hadn't developed or noticed before in the guitar. And actually, I have a project that I've written most of the music for, a string quartet and guitar. It's more of a classical, would be an ECM new series, but I'm still a little short. Need another piece or two, but I have rehearsed with the string quartet, and then that could be a nice project. So there's always something new to do. Just to keep your level of playing up requires a real involvement. I mean, you can't not touch the instrument and get away with it. I mean, it's one of the most cruel instruments that way. If you stop practicing, it takes you like twice as long to. For every day missed, it takes 2 days to recover.
It's discipline. Let me ask you something. When you're actually playing, say, for an audience, what actually goes through your head, if anything? I mean, are you able to step outside of yourself when you're performing, or?
Yeah, you have to, really. I mean, it's because there's no room really for kind of thoughts or verbal thoughts, like, oh, that was nice, or I'd like to do that, or I wonder what they think of this. Just the amount of time it takes for you to form a sentence like that, you've already lost like many, many seconds worth of music. I mean, you've lost your track of what you were doing. Mm. Because as you're playing music, I mean, you're basically, once you start playing, you establish that reference point from the very beginning. It's your own reference point as well. So you're telling a story in a sense, and you can't just sort of go walk about in and out, you know, of this, or you lose track. I mean, if you tell a story to a child, I mean, if you're making up it or you're reading it, I mean, it has to continue the intensity, and things have to happen in a consecutive way that maintain interest and sort of build tension. So when you're playing them, you can't. It's very risky to start wondering about whether your pants are unzipped or whether you've got a blotch. And you know what I mean? Things that are totally extra musical. And it's hard to keep that kind of concentration. It's difficult to do a perfect concert. But a perfect concert is when you're just as engrossed in the sound that's flowing out and the direction that it's going in terms of, intensity of the story, the musical story that's going on. It's like it is very much like another language, but it's so fast, the decisions that are being made, every note, every little movement, that you don't really have time to be thinking about things in a normal sense of thinking. Anyway, does that? But I mean, you owe that to the audience too, because you're as much a listener as they are, and it has to be engrossing to the point where it's not just a series of circus tricks or whatever.
Does it get emotional for you sometimes in terms of?
Absolutely, yeah. And but then if I let it get me too far, I screw up. You know? There's always this moment if I get pulled out of it or something, and I get so moved. I say I played a piece one time. I got so moved that it was going so well, and it was just toward the end, and I was just so overcome that I got lost to the end. I dropped the ball, you know, the end, and had a bad ending to it. You know, otherwise just inspired performance. So. Yeah. So, but I am emotional about it. Yeah, I mean, as I said, I mean, I'm part of the audience that I'm playing too. I mean, I'm listening as well as sort of inventing things, but I'm trying to follow it as a listener would too.
Now, you've played with so many talented musicians, too many to really cover off at this point in time and space. And having said that, at this point, where you are in your own life, is your preference towards solo work or still some sort of collaboration?
Well, I think I'm going to do another collaboration. There's a really great Italian trumpet player that I love. His name's Paolo Fresu is his name. And he's not so known anyway, but it's great. He's really famous in Italy, and in Europe getting more famous. But he's a great player and a mature player. And I thought we're thinking of a project probably recorded in New York, make kind of a New York group. And I've always wanted to feature the trumpet with the guitar. I mean, a Miles kind of player like this guy is, and with that kind of aesthetic, with the way I play classical guitars, always would be a great. Trumpet was one of my first instruments, other than just noodling on the piano, and I've always thought that would be a great combination. And we've done some concerts together, so I do have some group things in the future, plus the string quartet music, and then we always have organ. The organ, we just released our new record, which is only been out maybe a month tops.
It's called Prime.
I don't know if it's been out in Australia yet or not. But
this is the one that's called Prime?
Yeah, that's the new one. Yeah,
I haven't heard it, but I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. So you've actually heard about it, though.
Yeah, well, good. Through the Ralph Kalmar discussion group, anyway. And I think last time we spoke, which was 2002, which is, I think, when you last came out Down Under.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember, you said you had a little Italian group that you play with occasionally?
Well, it wasn't completely Italian. It was a trio, and we still now and then get together. Mm-hmm. It's an Italian singer named Maria Pia De Vito, a great improviser, wonderful voice. She actually writes lyrics too to some of my pieces, so, and a good composer she is. And John Taylor, the English piano player. We had a trio together. We did quite a bit of few concerts. And we did a recording too on an obscure English label called Verso was the name of the record, but the CD rather. And so that was a group. That was a group project for quite a while. Seems to have died down now. But
Do you still get excited by the prospect or the idea of live performance?
Yeah, absolutely. I get nervous and I get excited. Sometimes if I haven't played for a month or something, I haven't done a concert, I sometimes wonder as I'm sitting there warming up, can I possibly do this? You know, and so I'm never blasé about it, but I'm always excited about it. I mean, it's a pleasure to hear to be able to do it, to sit there and be transported somehow when things go well. I mean, it's always, every concert's an opportunity to go on another voyage. when it's going well, it sounds well, which it usually is nowadays. The technology is really good with sound systems and engineers. And so, in general, but I have to say I'm very excited about this guitar trio. Because I really like the other two guys' music, and I think that this could be, I think we'll see how it goes, but it sounds to me like it really has a lot of potential as a touring group, you know, even outside of Australia. So,
have you got any sort of regrets about not having performed with anyone? I remember somewhere reading that you made some comment about you would have liked to have perform with Astor or Piazzolla, given the chance.
Well, no, he actually, I met Astor, and he actually said, "Oh, I wanted to call you to play. I wanted you to be in this band." And he actually said that, but he said it, he was so cruel. He said it right in front of his faithful guitar player, who'd been playing with him for 20 years. And so Astor could be really nasty, I think. Mm. But Astor liked my playing and writing, but again, that would have been Astor's music, really, you know, and Astor's thing. So would have been fun, you know, but
it wasn't meant to be.
No, I don't really particularly want to be a tango guitarist anyway. You know what I mean? I mean, I love that music, but I think it's important to sort of stay within your realm in a certain way. I mean, I include a lot of things in my playing. Probably a little bit of tango, too. I mean, it's in there somewhere, but
it's kind of, it's a nice little intro, actually, into a nice little lead-in into my next question, because I was going to ask you if you could maybe talk a little bit about how, say, Brazilian music, as an example, has influenced your own compositional and playing style.
I think that's the heaviest influence of all the guitar bass music, because the time I was, as I say, trying to clone myself after Bill Evans on the piano, I was on a boat coming back from Europe after the first year, and I could play the guitar after studying in Vienna. And while I was on this freighter, this empty freighter that I'd managed to get passage on, I heard on the radio just a little bit of Brazilian music. Going, what the hell is that? It's incredible. And so by the time I got back to the States, that I was sort of digging up some Brazilian music was starting to hit just then. And the thing about it, I liked it. It has all the had all the jazz harmonies, and yet it had a comfortable rhythmic thing that that was really made for the guitar. The guitar just, it was a natural for that. So it was being able to use all my jazz harmonic technique and sensibilities with classical technique and being able to really play the guitar, having studied that, it just fit like a glove. So I did play quite a bit of just straight Brazilian music for a while, and so I learned a lot from that. And as far as the style, I started abstracting that style and going away from it, but it was a really good base, plus the great writers like Jobim and I really love that. It's a funny thing. I mean, the heaviest influences on my guitar playing, I would say, would be Baroque music in terms of voice leading and Bill Evans and the piano players, really more than anyone. And then the Brazilian writers, lyric writers and players. So, but I kind of sort of absorbed it and found a way that, because it's not often you find somebody who can improvise and compose that has really studied only the classical guitar, because I've never played another kind of guitar, a pick or anything, so I never really had to unlearn any particular version of guitar playing. I started strictly as a classical player. I mean, I really studied hard, and I really didn't do a lot of improvising when I was learning to play the guitar. I mean, I just really, as I said, 10 hours a day just worked on the expression and control and the musicianship involved in playing Renaissance and Baroque music and getting the classical guitar repertoire.
Is there a darker side to your creative output which you kind of choose consciously not to run with, or...?
I've said this before, though. I mean, usually when I start to write a piece, I have to sort of, I have to discover it. It's more, it's not as if you're creating anything. You're just combining things in a way that's personal. I mean, combining materials that already exist in a strange way. And if I stumble upon an idea that I can project into a piece, I mean, that's sort of the trick of composing, is being able to recognize when something's an idea and when it's not, when it's just a nice sound. If it's a very dark thing, doesn't depend on my mood really necessarily. I mean, I've written some very let's say happy pieces or bright pieces when I was depressed, and vice versa. So basically, when you discover a motive, I mean, you follow that, and it takes charge really, and it may not. I just think your sense. The sense of darkness or something, I mean, it just exists, and you're familiar with that world, and you don't have to be in that mood to write a particular piece. The mood doesn't really... the music establishes its own mood, and you follow that, the idea.
Mm. Have you considered maybe recording again with someone like John Abercrombie?
Well, I tell you, the duets that I've done, actually one of my favorite duets was with Gary Peacock, that combination. Mm. They were quite long-running affairs, these duets, I feel as though they were really said best in the, I usually only do two. Seems like it's worked out. There's only two recordings with each duet combination, even though they were like Gary Burton and Gary Peacock and Abercrombie. I mean, and John, we had long runs as a duo, a lot of concerts, but like two records apiece, basically, and. I felt now, I mean, I feel I don't want to particularly want to return and start doing revival duets and things like that. Mm. I think we really said what we had to say very well, and I think it's better
to move forward.
Yeah, really. because I don't particularly want to just repeat necessarily. That's one of the difficulties, is not repeating yourself and becoming kind of a parody of yourself. It's a little danger that all artists face. There's bound to be things. Sometimes certain repetition is. They say, "Well, that's your style," you know. But you have to. I try to be aware of not to just do it. You know what I mean? That you have to make a distinction between the two: what is style and what is repetition.
All right. Here's the technical question from a guitarist. he wanted to know, what is the tuning that you used on the song Nimbus?
I can't remember, but almost all these tunings sound the same. I mean, if you want to make a tuning, it sounds exactly like it.
Right. Do you want me to read to you?
One thing you don't do is start tuning any string up higher.
Right.
Because you'll break. Right. So basically, you start from the top and work. And I kept the outside strings in unison. The strange thing about that whole guitar started tuned down a step, let's say in standard 12-string tuning. But then you start. I left the first string, which normally is the E, but in this case it was a D, down a step. But rather than give all the notes, it was really the top strings and the bottom strings were in unison. They were still octave on the sixth chorus. Combination of two strings, and the first one is in unison, first chorus, and the sixth chorus was octave, but all the others are different notes. They're all different pitches, and basically they're all just they're every note of the scale of just a minor ninth chord, minor 11th, has all the notes in the scale are in it. So then you have to concoct some fingerings and because when you grab something, I mean, you're not going to have anything that's familiar. It's not like, but all these minor chords, when you do that, they sound the guitar sounds pretty much the same. I mean, it's once you do one of these tunings, it's pretty much they sound very familiar if it's a minor chord or not. But the Nimbus thing is just a big minor seventh chord all the way across, with thirds and seconds and sixths in the intervals in the middle. You just start. I mean, I'll improvise pieces where I just start tuning it out and tuning all these strings. Just go for some strings. Just start detuning it. And the thing about the 12 string is that you can have all these separate notes because of all these strings.
All right. Well, that's the only guitar player's question I'm going to ask you tonight. Not that I even understood a moment of that, but thank you.
Yeah, it's just a big minor chord, but it was only the two outside strings in unison or octave.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to ask you the last question. Okay, are you ready for this?
What kind of tree would you be?
No. When the time comes, God forbid, but how does Ralph Towner want to be remembered?
Oh, no, that's a terrible question. Yeah, right. I tell you, the one thing I would be, since I finally got around to publishing some of this music, and in this, particularly this last recording, there's one book of 10 solos, and there'll be a second volume that I'll publish with this company in San Francisco called Guitar Solo Publications. And what I would like, really, is just for people... musicians to play some of the music, particularly classical guitarists, and it would be nice if some of this music gets played by other people, really. And I have a piano piece, I'm particularly a classical piece, quite modern, long 20-minute piece that be nice if that surfaced again. I don't know. Be remembered as a good composer, I guess.
and I'm sure a wonderful human being.
That's open to discussion, I guess.
All right. On that note, I will just, I guess, first and foremost say thank you very, very, very much for your time, Ralph. And we look forward to obviously seeing you play yet again in Australia. And, you know, again, thank you for your time. I'm very